Well, thank you for inviting me here again. It's good to share with you. It's been, well, actually, it hasn't been all that long because I came by video last time, didn't I? But the last time I've actually physically been here is quite a long time ago. So it's good to see you all and to share with you. Some of you I recognise, some of you I don't, which is also good because that means growth and change and things have been going on. So it's good to be with you and good to share. I'm hoping in a minute there's a slide going to come. Not yet, but in a slide. We've got some slides, have we? We have, excellent. Yeah, we don't need them yet, that's fine. As I was thinking and praying and talking with God about what to talk about, what scriptures to bring to you today, Nehemiah kept coming back to me. It's a book I know quite well. In fact, I did my master's degree in this period, so I can bore you for hours. I'm not going to. Well, I hope I'm not going to. I've been told I've got to finish at a particular time, so we'll see if we can do that. But the book of Nehemiah is about rebuilding. And if ever there's a time in our church's history, of certainly of the last generation or so, where rebuilding is necessary, it's now. We've been through, well, I'm still going through because you're all still wearing masks. The pandemic, the lockdown, the shutdown, the thing that has changed our lives, our minds, our families, our work patterns, our health. It's changed so much. And the EA has done a study, Evangelical Alliance, about what that has done to church attendance. And you may have heard it already, but about a third of people are not back in churches at the moment because of a multitude of reasons. Some of it, it's because of health. Maybe it's fear. Maybe they're no longer with us. All sorts of reasons have combined to make that the case. But church today is not what church was 2 years ago. But we've had Zoom services, we've had outreach efforts, we've had different things happening because of lockdown. We've done social work in the communities, we've helped people with prescriptions and food deliveries. And church is not what it was 2 years ago. And that's either a good or a bad thing, you know, it's a bit of a both. But now we are coming out of lockdown, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. The government has decided it's going to happen. And it looks like we're moving from pandemic to endemic status. Whatever technical details that means, I'm not medical, but it looks like we're moving out of this season and into a new season of, you know, the pandemic or whatever it is. And as a church, we've got to adapt again, got to rebuild again. And as we do so, we've got to ask ourselves some very major questions. What are we rebuilding? Why are we rebuilding it? Is it the right thing to rebuild? And how, given the pressures and the problems that we face in the pandemic, can we rebuild anyway? Because it's very common to see, firstly, fewer people in church. Secondly, fewer volunteers. People are willing to stand up and do something. Thirdly, people with enough energy and health to actually do anything anyway. Everyone's exhausted and worn out by the whole thing. So how do we rebuild? And that's why I wanted to come to Nehemiah. But in doing so, I had a little problem. I thought, yeah, Nehemiah chapter 1, no problem. I know where I want to go with this. And so I started to prepare and started to study. But I don't know whether it ever happens to you when you start to, maybe in the Bible study before communion, you start to study and the passage starts to run away with you a little bit. And it has a bit with me. I wanted to just do Nehemiah chapter 1. That's easy. But I got a bit stuck and I've done the whole book. Sorry. we're not going to be here very long. We're going to have to go through it really, really fast. But because I've done the whole book, I've got some slides for us which will perhaps help us stay where we are and understand where we are with it. So chapter 1. Let's just start reading just a few verses of chapter 1. And I've got the New International Version. It's probably what you've got, but if not, it'll keep you on your toes, won't it? The words of Nehemiah, son of Halkiah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year. While I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and all about Jerusalem. I stop there a moment. 2,500 years ago, the Jews as a people were divided. Some of them were living in Israel. A lot of them were not. Because back in their grandfather's day, they were all exiled from Israel. They couldn't live in the land at all. But back in their granddad's day, a bunch of people with the leadership of Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar came back and they led a few of the Jews back to Israel. And everyone was, yay, this is brilliant, celebrate. And they built the temple and life was great. That was two generations ago. And so some of the Jews were now living in Israel, but most were still scattered across what was by that time the Persian Empire. Nehemiah is one of the ones scattered across the Persian Empire. They hadn't gone back to the Promised Land. His dad hadn't gone back to the Promised Land. In fact, most people hadn't gone back. There's just a faithful few, if you like, in Israel. And then the bulk of the people, they're not back yet. So they've built the temple, but there's not a lot of people in it. Most of Israel hasn't come back yet. Oh, that sounds a familiar sort of idea, doesn't it? Well, there he is anyway. And he is actually the cupbearer to the king, we're going to discover, which doesn't sound like a really good job, really. But, I mean, you want to imagine, you know, I don't know if you watch The Crown or any of these other royals programmes that are on the telly, but they've always got these very well-dressed servants, haven't they, who seem to have a lot of influence and a lot of authority. And, well, he was the cupbearer to the king, like the butler, maybe. He was one of the inner circle who saw the king every day. And he would know what the king was like. He would know what mood the king was in. He would have a lot of influence and power with the king. And every time he'd come out from the king, there'd all be these old courtiers lined down the corridor saying, I want to see the king today with my petition. Is it a good day to see the king? And Nehemiah has this authority. He can say, yeah, it's a good day to see the king, or no, it's not. And he can sort of control who has access to the king based on the king's mood. So it's a powerful, if subservient, sort of position that Nehemiah has. Anyway, there he is. And these people come to him, friends from Israel. They've come all the way from Jerusalem, and he has a good chat with them. What's happening there? How is it there? How are the Jews doing? Are they okay? And they report in verse 3. Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned by fire. That's not very good news, is it? But hang on a minute. The date is 445 BC. The walls of Jerusalem and its gates that had been burned by fire hadn't been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. Now you need to do some numbers. Now the numbers are backwards because these are BC years, they go backwards, they go, you know, bigger as you get further away. But 586 BC down to 445 BC, that's quite a long time, isn't it? 140 years, give or take. You can do your maths. He's a bit behind the times if he's only just discovered 140 years later that the walls have been broken down. There's something else going on here. Nehemiah is shocked, saddened by the news. He says that in verse 4. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now, is he completely out of touch? Does he not know the news that these walls were destroyed 140 years ago? Don't think that's the deal. So either this really very old news that everybody's known for years has suddenly hit him with an intensity he's not known before, or, and we don't know the answer to this, but or there has been a recent attempt to rebuild the walls which has failed. Now, we do know that in that time, a few years before 445, where we are now, there had been a rebellion against the Babylonians led by a guy called Megabyzus. That's not in the Bible. You've got to go into ancient sort of texts to find that. But there had been a rebellion in the area, so it's possible that they had rebuilt the walls and the walls have been destroyed by the Babylonians as the rebellion failed. We don't know which that is. Was this a real moment of God breaking into Nehemiah and saying, "Oi!" on this really very old news, you've got to do something about it? Or was this a recent thing? We can't tell. But what we do know is it has become a burden upon Nehemiah. The state of Jerusalem is shameful. The state of God's people is shameful. God, what are you going to do? And that really takes us to our step one. In chapter one, pray. And that's what Nehemiah does. He sees that there is a problem. A major problem. And God, it's shameful. And God, please God, do something about it for the honour of your name. And you can go through the text and you can talk about how he structures his prayer. And there's a little bit of a clue. It is on the wall behind me. That's good. A little bit of clue on the wall about that structure. And if you want to, you can go away and research that and think about that and look at structures of prayers, which is really very helpful. I haven't got time, so we'll have to leave it up there. But he prays, and that's crucial, and that's a very important first step. So for us, we haven't got walls around. In fact, walls around cities these days are a real pain, aren't they? They make bottlenecks of things. I know it's nice for the tourists to walk around the walls and everything, but the traffic has real trouble when you get walled towns. But back then, a walled town was really important because it defined the town. It said, the town is here. With a wall, it's protectable. You know, the citizens within it are safe. It's a city. It's arrived. You see, back in his granddad's day, God had said, I will reestablish Jerusalem. And they'd built the temple, but for some reason, they'd never built the walls, or the walls had been knocked down again, depending on how you read the text. So God's promises haven't been fulfilled. God's purposes aren't complete. God's people are mucking about. It's one way of putting it. In fact, Haggai talks a bit about this. Now he's talking about it when they're struggling building the temple, let alone the walls. So that is back in Granddad's day, Haggai's book is. And he's saying, look, you're mucking about and God isn't happy with you because you need to get out there and rebuild and focus upon what you're supposed to be doing. That's not where we are necessarily. But we are standing in a similar place where God's church, God's kingdom, God's people have been battered. The numbers aren't what they were. The connections with the community aren't what they were. A community itself isn't what it was. We aren't what we were. And God's kingdom needs to be rebuilt. And we need to look at God's kingdom and say, what needs to be rebuilt? Where is the shame? Where's the rebuke? Where is the thing that needs to be put back and put back right? Or maybe put back in a new way. Pray. That's step one, and that's crucial. If we don't do this, we can start to think, well, okay, I think we should do this. I know, I think we should do this. And we'll head off in different directions, and chaos will ensue. And probably nothing will get done, because we're all pulling in different directions. Pray. What's the one thing? Now, in Nehemiah's day, there were lots of problems. That they talked about, you know, the people are in great trouble and disgrace. They're in verse 3. And the wall is broken. Now, there were lots of problems we could have picked from. Nehemiah picks that one. That's the one that God wants us to deal with. That's the one where shame and disgrace is coming. That's the one which I'm going to mourn about. That's the one that God is convicting my heart over. Pray. That's step one. Step two. Let's go into chapter two. Chapter 2, verse 1, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought to him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, this is the month Nisan. Chapter 1, verse 1, began in the month Kislev. Now, I'm sure you've got a Jewish calendar at home and you can work out exactly what's going on, but that's about 4 months gone by. So the news comes and he prays in chapter one. In chapter two, we're 4 months later. Okay, so he's been praying a long time. And nothing much has happened so far. Anyway, he's praying now, and it's in the month of Nisan in chapter 2. And he takes the wine and gives it to the king in verse 1 there. I had not been sad in his presence before, verse 1 says. Which is a bit of a weird sort of statement, isn't it? What's that doing there? And very simply, it's not a good career move to be sad in the presence of the king. Because the king can have your head chopped off, and Persian kings have a bit of a reputation about chopping people's heads off. Look in the book of Esther if you want to find out more about the sorts of ways kings in those days behaved. Esther chapter 1. But you don't go to be sad in front of the king because it's likely to shorten your life a little bit. But he does today. 4 months later than when the news came, he's sad. Again, is Nehemiah really slow? This sadness of face, is not an instant reaction to the news that came yesterday because his mates told him Jerusalem was down. Oh, I'm feeling really glum because of that. This sadness is 4 months later. This sadness is engineered. Today, he's sad. Now, remember I told you he knows the mood of the king? He knows the good days to pick to go and bring a petition. He knows the bad days to bring a petition. Well, today, 4 months later, today he's sad. And the king says, why does your face look so sad when you're not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. Verse 2 ends with the phrase, I was very much afraid. The king's spotted that I'm sad. And then he says, but I said to the king, may the king live forever, which is what you've got to say when you talk to the king. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what do you want? That was the key moment. That was the bit. That was what he was hoping for. That was what he was afraid he wasn't going to get. The king's in a good mood. He could have said, you're sad. Don't bother me with your sadness. I don't want you to be sad. You're supposed to make me happy. Get out of here, or chop a couple of feet off your body or whatever. He could have said all sorts of unpleasant, nasty things, being the king. But Nehemiah's picked the day right. This is careful manipulation stuff. The king says, what is it you want? And then you get this lovely phrase in verse 4. I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king. Up there we've got the phrase arrow prayer. And that's what this is. Help, I'm in trouble. Quick, shove a quick prayer up to God before I open my mouth and say what I need to say. It can only last a couple of seconds because that's all the time I've got before I answer the king. But I'll drop a prayer in quick. And we're good at those. Trouble is, what I find anyway, is I tend to rely on those and forget that Nehemiah spent 4 months praying before we get to the arrow prayer. Yeah? Arrow prayers are great if you've got 4 months behind you first. Arrow prayers with nothing behind you are asking for trouble, really. But he shoves up this prayer, says, God help, and then he delivers a plan. Off the top of his head, he's been thinking about this for 4 months. And he says, well, okay, I'll need a leave of absence letter. I'll need some letters of authority. I'll need some trees, materials, stuff to build a city walls with. I need a bodyguard. And he comes up with a list of stuff. And the king says, yeah, you can have that. I want you back. You're only on loan, as it were. But yeah, I like your plan. I like your passion. I like your heart. Off you go. There's a plan. The prayer has led to a plan. And this is one of the worrying things about prayer. You start to pray passionately about something, and God starts to stir your own heart. I'm sure Nehemiah, at the beginning of chapter 1, wasn't thinking, oh, I've got to do this. It's God, you've got to do this. And God, over those 4 months, started to say, yeah, I'm going to do something, but can you help? I want your help. I want you involved in this too. And the more Nehemiah started to pray, the more the answer was, here am I, send me. Now, didn't want to talk about this bit, but actually this is where it really hits the road, because you guys, when you rebuild God's kingdom here in Beaches, it's great to pray, God, do it. But the longer you spend praying, God, do it, the more God is going to say, okay, this is what I want you to do. And it's not just Tim, it's not just the elders, it's all of us. God has a place for all of us, and that perhaps is where we need to go into chapter 3. Got a map on the wall there. Yeah, about. Those are the walls of Jerusalem as built by Nehemiah, according to the great, long and very boring chapter 3. If you've read all the way through chapter 3, well done, you deserve a medal. It's really quite difficult, because it's just lots of names. But if you see it in a picture, it's much easier. I call this level Plod, because there's so much detail here, and it's heavy going detail. I mean, building walls is dirty work, heavy work, muddy work, discouraging work. Particularly at the beginning, you build a wall, you spend most of your time at the beginning just taking everything away. Getting it flat, getting it level, getting it solid, getting it so that it won't fall down. All the pretty stuff is right at the very end. There's a lot of hard graft. There's a lot of plod. Building God's kingdom means turning up on Monday morning and doing this, or Friday evening and doing that. It means week by week, when there aren't very many people, there isn't very much response, things aren't looking good, the rainy days. Plod. Building God's kingdom isn't about the joy and the excitement of the answered prayer meetings on the Sunday night or whatever it is you're doing on Zoom, I see. It's about the hard plod. But there's careful planning in the detail here. If you look at those verses 23, 28, 29 or 30, you'll see that what he does is he organises the people to build the wall right opposite their house. Yeah, I want a strong piece outside my house. I want a well-built bit out. I don't want it falling down. I don't want that to be the place where the enemy comes through, right outside my house. So, there's a bit of motivation going on here. There's some clever psychology going on here. Nehemiah is organising the people very carefully. All the people. Verse 10. Shalom gets his girls doing it. So, you ripe for this? This is you as well. It's not just the grown-ups. It's everybody getting involved. Or we could go to Merimoth. Don't know who Merimoth was, but he was a real a Duracell bunny of a guy. He does a bunch of walls in verse 4 and another bunch in verse 21. I mean, does he just have a lot of people? Was he overseeing them? Was he just working twice as hard as everybody else? I don't know, but he gets everybody organised and everything's very carefully detailed and laid out according to the map that we've got up there. So the whole work gets done and gets built, but it's a hard graft and it takes everyone in their own areas. So whatever your expertise is, whatever your thing is, that's where God wants you to build and fit that into the master plan so that the entire wall is seamless rather than jiggly and higgly piggly and sort of in bits that don't connect with one another. That would be a useless sort of a wall, wouldn't it? So, pray, plan, plot. I'm doing well, three P's. Chapters 4 to 6 come next, and we really can't stop with these, but I leave them with you because they detail problems. And if you're ever looking for some chapters on spiritual warfare, these are great ones. They're really quite exciting in places. But there are four different problems, generic types of problems that come up here. We've got the enemy without, the enemy within, the enemy of deceit, and then you've got the enemy of just the everyday plod getting you down. They're really rather exciting passages. There's a bit of a James Bond thing with double agents going on in places, back there in chapter 6 particularly. We can't explore them now. No, we really can't explore them now. Time is going. But I give them over to you to have a think about. And I'll leave the PowerPoint here so people can get it off the sound desk at the back if they want it as well. But they're great fun to read through. All sorts of problems come. Nehemiah faces all those problems and he has a solution for all those problems. And that's the bit we need to really learn from. All these problems are going to come to us, have come to us, are coming to us. We may be in the middle of them now, maybe. The clue as to how to deal with them is there in the passages. And that's what makes it really helpful. So I hold up chapters 4-6 to you as a great example of how to cope when all the problems come. Because come they will. But we can't stop there. We've got to flee on into chapters 7 and 8. By now, the wall is built. But we're only halfway through the book. Don't let complacency catch you, in other words. The wall is built. That which God wanted us to do is done. My responsibility now is keep it in good order. Make sure the right people are in the right place to make it function as it should. It's here, but it's now got to work. You know, as a wall, it needs certain things. As the plan, whatever God's plan for you is, it will need certain things, certain people in certain places, certain gifts, certain resources. Make sure they're there and they're right. Make sure the people doing these things have it in their good hands, if you like, in chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. After the wall had been rebuilt, and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the musicians and the Levites were appointed, I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most people do. That means he had the awe and the wonder of God, not the, I'm terrified type of thing. Get good people in good places. And then, chapter 8, Ezra reads the law to them. Now, they know the law already. Ezra's been around for 13 years now. He came in 456 BC. So he's been reading this law to them for a while. But today, as we dedicate this wall to God, as we dedicate the plans and purposes of God, we're dedicating ourselves to God again. And we're finding out what God wants from us, and we're, perhaps if you like, starting a new cycle of pray and plan. And then there's a party at the end of chapter 8. Praise, celebration, worship. God is good, God has done. And that's really important. You might think, actually, I've got all the blisters to show that I was the one who did this. But I only did it in the strength and with the power and the encouragement and the resources that God has provided for me. Let us give him the praise for it, and let's set a marker so that in generations to come we can look back and say, yes, I know God is powerful because. See that wall? In fact, see that wall? There it is. That's a bit of the wall that Nehemiah built. Still there today. Now there's lots of bits of wall in Jerusalem because Jerusalem's an ancient city. But this bit dates to Nehemiah's time. So we're not talking about a random passage here. This is history. This is what actually happened. And it stands there as a monument still to the fact that God keeps his promises and his honour. And if his people, as we go back to that passage in 2 Chronicles, will humble themselves and pray. Must flee on. Let's go to the last little bit, chapter 13, actually, probably most of all. Chapters 9 to 12 are about making sure that everything's in the right place, people are in the right place, and the wall is as it should be, where we're making sure this is going to function. But chapter 13, all I put there is watch out for the red ants. Not literal ants, but actually in the text we've got fifth columnists, we've got infiltrators, we've got people who are coming, sneaking in, pretending to be goodies, but are actually baddies. They're creeping in to bring a bad influence, the red ants that come and nibble away at the timbers and hollow out. We had Death Watch Beetle in the house that I was in once, and the bathroom floor just one day suddenly just disappeared and fell down to the room underneath, which was my daughter's bedroom, which was a bit scary. But as we saw what the damage was, these big oak beams, it was an ancient old house, 500 years old. These huge old timbers were completely hollow. I could put my arm straight down the middle of these beams. The beetles had just hollowed the timber away completely. Red ants are famous for doing that sort of thing. Watch out for them. Don't let them hollow out the work you're doing so that all remains is just a shell. Preserve the vision God has given. Make it function for the purposes to which it was given. Don't let it become just a formality that we do because that's who we are. So, Nehemiah is about rebuilding in six steps, which is in the last slide, I think. I said I finished before quarter two, well, I'm going to, we're all right. So there they are. I don't know whether you've already started praying and you know the direction and the vision God has for you for the next year or years. If you haven't, now's the time to start. Let that prayer dwell in you. Let it build in you a passion, a burden. Let's go back to Nehemiah chapter 1. When I heard these things, this is verse 4, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the Lord of heaven. And then I said. So pray. And then plan. What resources do I need? What people do we need? What money do we need? How are we going to tackle this? Now, what has God placed in our hands already? And how can I use it? How can I be used as part of that plan? Because it rests on all of your shoulders. And then do, which is going to be the hard bit. It's the nitty-gritty, the grind. And in the middle of all of that, these problems will come. But if you're faithful, God will take you to that place of praise. And then you merely have to persevere. So may God bless you as you step into his plans for this year. Amen.